From the Moment Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. May Martinez. Gavin Newsom says the homelessness crisis in California is a disgrace. And while he promised to take quick action on it, we'll hear how fast his proposals could actually start making a dent. Plus, been thinking about trading your car commute for a train or bus? A lot of us have, but a new survey shows what's stopping most Angelenos from actually making the switch. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. On the show, a new survey from USC reveals some of the reasons why more people don't use public transportation in LA, and personal safety is one of them.
One of the top commonly cited concerns residents have with both forms of public transit is the behavior of other riders.
Plus, we head up to Humboldt County in Northern California to check in on some of the unintended economic consequences of legal marijuana. All that's coming up. First, though, let's talk about the state of the state. It's the yearly address given by the governor. And earlier today, Gavin Newsom told the legislature these stark words: "We are failing Californians on homelessness."
Let's call it what it is. It's a disgrace that the richest state in the richest nation, succeeding across so many sectors, is falling so far behind to properly house, heal, and humanely treat so many of its own people.
He spent his entire speech on the problem and indicated that his office will push for initiatives on many different levels in order to address it. In the room was Guy Marzorati, politics and government reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Guy, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, let's start with something unusual, because it's not often that a governor uses the pulpit for their State of the State address to focus on one issue. I just remember last year, Guy, he seemed to be all over the place focusing on a lot of different things. Today, just one thing.
You're so right. I mean, this is often an opportunity for a governor to lay out a vast agenda for the coming year and even spend a lot of time, celebrating legislative victories from the previous year. This was really a singular focus on homelessness from Governor Newsom. And look, we've seen this a few times before in history. Gray Davis in 2003, his final State of the State was all about the economy. Jerry Brown in 2011 was really focused on the state budget. And it's a risk. You know, if a governor says this is the single issue I'm going to focus on, well, then I think it's fair for voters to say this is the single issue we'll judge you on. And that turned out very poorly for Davis and very well for Brown.
Was part of the reason for that is to kind of just put the message out there that this will be his singular focus in 2020?
Yeah, I think the real audience when you talk about State of the State is the state legislature. I mean, we air the speech statewide for all of our listeners, but really the audience that the governor has in mind is the folks in front of him in the Assembly and the Senate, and really articulating, here's going to be my vision for the year. In this case, really articulating, here's the singular issue I'm focused on. Governors have a tremendous amount of political capital that comes with the state budget, and I think it's clear through the budget and then through the state of the state that all that energy on Newsom will be focused on homelessness.
Now, his words were carefully chosen, but the subtext is that the problem preceded his time in office. He only started last year, and that past lawmakers did not take swift action.
The problem has persisted for decades, caused by massive failures in our mental health system, disinvestment in our social safety net, exacerbated by widening income inequality and California's housing shortage. The hard truth is for too long we've ignored this problem.
And he also pinned part of the blame on cities and counties throughout California.
I even heard local official just recently proclaim, said loudly, "Not my problem." Servants of the public that are too damn busy pointing fingers to step up and help. That's shameful.
Guy, how did that go over with the crowd? And actually, fact-checking history a bit, is the governor right?
Yeah, I think, this is an issue that's been with Newsom dating back to his time as mayor of San Francisco. He sees this through a local lens, and I think also sees the role, productive role that a state could play as a partner. He's certainly correct in the fact that this has been a crisis years in the making. It's only recently, though, that it's really entered, the lexicon of the larger state in terms of a priority. I mean, this was something that barely registered in public polling. All of a sudden, we now have it as the top priority for California voters. I think, you make a good point about the local governments. This is going to be a constant push and pull that Newsom has. He has a task force of mayors with whom he's getting suggestions on how to address homelessness. But, you know, he often says shelters solve sleep, housing solves homelessness. I would add shelters solve votes for a lot of mayors. And mayors are often want, you know, direct cash grants, cash infusions from Sacramento. And I think what Newsom signaled in this speech was there's going to be a little more strings attached going forward on that funding.
When he was calling out public servants, was he looking in anyone's direction in particular? I don't know if maybe there was...
You know, I was seated to the side, so he certainly might have been. And there was, you know, certainly there were some parts of Newsom's speech when he talked about housing development where even Democrats in the room were not standing up and applauding. I think that's certainly, as we've seen through the vehicle of Senate Bill 50, that's been a very controversial issue in trying to mandate local governments to approve more dense housing. That's certainly has tails as it relates to the homelessness crisis, but it's something that Newsom doesn't have the unanimous support of Democrats in the room for.
Now, the governor talked about investing in the state's healthcare system and making things such as mental health care more accessible. Can you break down the numbers on what he wants to spend and where it would go?
Right. So, I mean, one of the big things Newsom wants to have happen is counties to spend more of the money that they are already getting through Proposition 63 and using that towards the mentally ill homeless. And this would be done in partnership with an expansion of the conservatorship laws in California, something that Newsom has pushed for and something that we've already seen expanded in some localities like San Francisco. Basically, this is a way for local governments to compel mentally ill homeless folks into care. And it's very controversial. Look, there's civil liberties advocates that say this goes beyond the pale in terms of taking away an individual's rights. And there is still remains the problem that even if you put people into care, and this is something San Francisco has faced, do you have the funding, do you have the beds to actually provide care to those people?
The civil liberties part that you just mentioned, is that something that Newsom maybe might consider a down-the-road problem? Let's get the money first and throw that first at the problem and then worry about the other thing later.
You know, I don't think so. I think this is something he's going to try to take on and expand this year. I mean, we've already seen pilot programs, as I mentioned, in San Francisco, San Diego. I actually think he's going to really try to push this and expand this statewide, try to put some more, easy requirements to be able to compel people into care. Right now, it often depends on how many times they've been placed on a 5150 hold. I think Newsom might actually try to expand that, even though that was another one of the issues today where he didn't have a lot of or all the Democrats in the room standing and applauding.
Now, what are the chances this idea has in the legislature and the court system?
Well, I think it's going to be a tough proposition in the legislature. Look, this is something that even when it was introduced in the last couple of years as a pilot program for three specific cities was still pretty controversial. But I think this is, again, one of the things that Newsom has to, if he's really going to make a dent on this issue, it can't all be carrots. It can't all be using the budget to send money down to local governments. There has to be some kind of regulatory reform, whether that's conservatorships or even something that you've seen in LA where CEQA exemptions, basically exempting homeless shelters and supportive housing from environmental lawsuits. That's another idea that Newsom has seen be effective on the local level that he wants to take statewide. I mean, it really, the idea was kind of spawned after opponents of that homeless shelter at the Venice Metro Yard filed an environmental lawsuit. Now LA has an exemption, CEQA exemption for shelters. Newsom wants to expand that. And I think that's another one of those ideas that maybe butts up against some Democrats who view CEQA as a fair environmental law that is really protecting and giving voice to local concerns.
You know, you mentioned how applause ebbed and flowed depending on what was being brought up. Any particular times it really got loud and then other times where there was nothing there?
Well, it usually ebbs when money is mentioned. I think that's something that the legislature and especially Democratic leadership can get their head around because, you know, frankly, the state's economy is doing incredibly well. There is a lot of money in the coffers. When you start getting into regulatory changes, it becomes a lot more controversial, especially because housing, homelessness, this is for throughout California's history, largely been a purview of local governments. And part of Sacramento stepping in to provide more funding is also Sacramento stepping in to say, and here's how we'd like you to spend it. And here's some rule changes that we think would make it easier to get, you know, supportive housing and shelters built.
Talking about Gavin Newsom's State of the State with Guy Marzorati, politics and government reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Now, last month, as part of the governor's budget proposal, he wanted to spend $1.4 billion toward homelessness initiatives. But a criticism to that was that it was a one-time spending item. Today, though, he suggested that he'll be working with state lawmakers to create something a little bit more long-term.
So in the next few months, look, I've pledged to work with all of you closely to identify where this ongoing revenue will come from, but we've got to find it to provide safer, cleaner streets the communities that we represent deserve. It's time to muster the political will to meet this moment. People of California, you know this, are demanding bold, permanent solutions. Anything less is not going to get the job done.
Now that's fine, Guy, but did he offer any specifics there?
He did not, and I think this is going to be an ongoing question throughout the summer. How does Newsom work with legislative leadership to get that ongoing funding source? It's been a roadblock in years past. I mean, look, just last year, there was a bill to divert some local property taxes, basically kind of a redevelopment 2.0 for affordable housing. That didn't make it very far. And even on issues like clean water last year, you saw where Democrats were in wide agreement. They were not in wide agreement to create a new tax for the measure. So I think this is something where Newsom is going to have to find a workout, a way where if he can't get the votes for a tax increase, they're going to have to either put something on the ballot or find some creative way to create that new sustainable revenue source. But again, that's where it really gets down to brass tacks and some difficult decisions for Democratic leadership.
Is he committed, though, to just that avenue and that avenue only? In other words, not doing another one-time spending item in the future?
Well, there's certainly going to be one-time spending, and you've seen it in the budget as it relates to homelessness. But I think he sees the need for ongoing spending, especially as the state tries to move in a direction where it's not just direct block grants handed out to cities, where they're really trying to put together a more long-term regional strategy around homelessness. And he alluded to some of that in his speech today. That's going to cost money. That's going to cost added overhead, even though he said he wants to keep overhead on any kind of regional collaboration at around 10%. It's still going to be an ongoing cost. The question is, where does that ongoing money come from?
Thing is, though, putting things on the ballot still leaves it up to the voters to decide. It kind of leaves it up to chance a bit. Is there anything he can do on an executive level to just kind of make things happen?
Well, I mean, the budget is something the governor has a large amount of leeway over. But I would actually say, you know, when it comes to taking things to the voters on this issue, we've seen movement. As I mentioned, this is now, you know, a PPIC poll showed earlier this year. This is the top priority of Californians as they see what they want from their state government. And you're already seeing, and this gets back to the kind of political angle of this, but Kevin Faulkner, the mayor of San Diego, starting out a ballot committee to explore solutions to homelessness statewide. It seems like through one way or another, there will be some local state ballot measures potentially coming up on the issue of homelessness. So this might be Newsom's way to try to get ahead of that politically.
Now, another part of the homelessness crisis is the housing crisis. And the governor took aim at that and suggested that he would back laws that would spur development.
This means a commitment right now, this year, to major reform that will eliminate red tape and delays for building critically needed housing, like affordable multifamily homes, especially near transit and downtowns. I am committed. I'm committed to working with the leaders of both the Senate and the Assembly to craft and pass these needed reforms.
Yes, you definitely heard the applause build there. Guy, I got to think back to Senate Bill 50. That's Senator Wiener's bill that would have compelled cities to create more affordable multifamily homes near transit and downtown. Recently died for the third straight year. Where was the governor when this law needed more backing and needed more support? Would state lawmakers be swayed to vote in favor of something like this if Newsom actually put some weight behind it?
Well, that's the question we heard from advocates of Senate Bill 50. Why didn't the governor apply more pressure to get that specific bill done, given he has this larger goal of spurring development in the state? The governor's office certainly did try some last-minute lobbying on that particular bill. But, you know, again, this is a bill that comes down to local concerns. You saw half a dozen Southern California Democrats in the Senate oppose the measure. It makes it harder that this is an election year. You have some folks like Senator Holly Mitchell in Los Angeles. She's running for supervisor. Those are added political concerns on supporting any kind of measure that would take away local control. So it's certainly going to be an uphill battle for any kind of thing that Newsom wants to bring forward as it relates to zoning reform.
Yeah, LA City Council unanimously rejected it out of hand. Is this going to be one of those things where if he does somehow try to back an idea like this, or maybe to try and revive Senate Bill 50 with Wiener again, that he'd have to maybe go face to face with people and try to explain why he would want to have this done?
Yeah, I think we certainly might see a more public advocacy campaign from Newsom if an idea like this were to come around again. He so far has played a much more behind-the-scenes role on the SB 50 this year and the previous iterations. I would say in the meantime, I think what the governor has signaled today in his State of the State speech is that he's going to use the budget as a kind of lever to compel more action from local governments. And we've seen that before as he's set benchmarks he wants to see local governments hit before they can get more state money. I think you're going to see a similar vein of that when it comes to homelessness. He wants to see accountability on the local government side, and a way he can do that without having to pass a really ambitious zoning reform is to use those levers in the budget.
One more thing. After everything that you saw and heard from the halls of the state legislature today, can you give us a forecast on how successful Governor Newsom might be in these initiatives? You think he'll have the will, the political will from state and local lawmakers to greenlight a majority of his ideas?
Well, you know, I think something like this goes a long way in telegraphing to the legislature, this is my absolute focus. It actually gives a governor leverage in the same way we saw with Governor Jerry Brown when he really kept his focus to two or three different issues. It leaves a governor less vulnerable to having all these chips out on the board and having lawmakers being able to leverage them at different points. If he's able to approach this year with this kind of singular focus, I think it gives him a better chance. But again, as he laid out today, this is a problem decades in the making. It might be a problem decades to solve.
Guy Marzorati, politics and government reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Guy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. I know commuting in your car can be a pain. There are a lot of cars on the road and seemingly not enough lanes to make everything move smoothly. So have you ever thought about trading that car commute for a train or bus? Yeah, a lot of us have, but a new survey shows the one big reason that's stopping most Angelenos from actually making that switch. Find out what that is when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. University of Southern California dropped its mobility report this morning. It's a survey of the transportation habits of people living in this city, and it offers some insight into why it's so hard to get Angelenos to use public transportation in this town. And one hint, security is an issue. Here with us to talk about it is Kyla Thomas, associate sociologist at the Center for Economic and Social Research at USC, who conducted the study. Kyla, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, no surprise, the most popular and common form of transportation in L.A. are people's cars, individual personal cars. But just how entrenched is L.A.'s car culture, according to the numbers?
Yeah, about 89% of L.A. residents report having used their personal car in the last year. And then when we also look at frequency of use, how often do you use your car every week, we find that the majority of residents are using their car multiple days a week.
Yeah, anyone that rides the freeway sees all those single passenger cars. They know that everyone is using their cars pretty much.
Right. And we find that about a third of residents report relying solely on their cars. We gave them a bunch of transportation modes to select as having used in the last year. And a third of residents say that they only used their car. You know, we had walking available, scooters, public transit, and, you know, a third of people just the car.
Now, how many of the Angeleno surveys said they ride the metro or a bus?
So about 35% of residents say they used some form of public transit, and then we ask them specifically what form. And we find about 28% of residents used the Metro Light Rail at least once in the last year, and 24% report having used the bus at least once in the last year.
What reasons did people give as to why they prefer a car over public transit?
So we asked people about their perceptions of the car, the bus, the metro, and ride hailing. And we asked them to rate these different transit modes in terms of their kind of perceptions of the personal safety they feel using these modes, how convenient they are for work, for personal or leisure trips, how expensive do they find them to be, and how enjoyable are they. And we find that on all dimensions except cost, the personal car ranks the highest, much higher than public transit.
So when it comes to that part, I can see a little bit why. You know, you're in your car, you're alone, no one's there to, you know, maybe pressure you into handing over a wallet or a purse or something like that. Is that one of the basic reasons, their own personal safety in that way?
One of the top commonly cited concerns residents have with both forms of public transit is the behavior of other riders, and also concerns about safety getting to the bus or metro, and riding on the bus or metro also ranks pretty high.
Anything else they specifically cite?
So actually at the top of the list for the bus was transit time being too long. And at the top of the list for the metro was no stops close by. So convenience is also a big factor in terms of, you know, what's dissuading public transit use. And we find that when it comes to the metro, concerns about safety do seem to be keeping some people off the metro. But the real thing that's keeping people from using the metro and the bus frequently is convenience for work or school.
Yeah, there's not an unlimited amount of hours in the day. And if you don't have much, you don't want to spend it on a bus or a metro if you can avoid it.
Right. That does seem to be a big factor, even more so than safety.
Talking to Kyla Thomas, Associate Sociologist at the Center for Economic and Social Research at USC. So what helps encourage public transit use?
So we find that in the case of the bus, proximity to a stop is definitely a big factor that's impacting whether or not you use the bus at all. Also, if you live in a neighborhood where parking is difficult, you tend to be more likely to use the bus. That was kind of interesting to see. But when it comes to what drives you to use the bus frequently, it's convenience for work. I mean, that's really the main thing that drives people to use the bus every day. It needs to be convenient for daily necessities.
Another thing I took from this, Kyla, is that one way to get people to use more public transit is to make driving more difficult. Explain that one.
Right. So we find that people who own a car are less likely to use the bus or the metro, and people who have easier access to street parking are less likely to use the bus and the metro. So kind of one implication of that could be if you make parking more expensive or less accessible, if you could make cars more expensive, perhaps that would lead to an increase in public transit use. Necessity really seems to be a big factor that encourages public transit use. When you make it necessary to use public transit and you make it convenient for daily necessities, that's when people are more likely to use it.
All right, so we've covered two big modes of transportation, private car use and public transportation. What did you learn about other ways people use to get around, like ride sharing, say?
We've had some pretty interesting findings regarding ride hailing. You know, there's a big debate right now about, you know, does ride hailing compete with public transit or does it complement public transit? And what we find when we look at the relationship between ride hailing use and public transit use is that there's actually a positive association. So the more likely you are to use ride hailing, the more likely you are to use public transit. You know, among public transit users, we find that the more frequently you use public transit, the more frequently you use ride hailing. And in fact, the most frequent users of public transit, lower income residents, we also find to be the most frequent users of public transit. And that was pretty surprising.
Lower income people use ride sharing more often. What can we learn from that information? Because that jumped out at me a little bit.
Yeah. When you're just looking at whether a person used ride hailing at all in the last year, it is, as expected, higher income residents. So you're more likely to use ride hailing at all if you're higher income. But when we look at people who are using ride hailing, we find that higher income people tend to be more occasional users and lower income people are more likely to use it, you know, a few days a week or most days a week. And our thinking here is that people are probably using ride hailing in tandem with public transit as a substitute for the car.
I was thinking, yeah, no car payment, no insurance payment. Now it's starting to kind of add up a little bit.
Right. And when you maybe rely on public transit for most trips, but maybe there are certain trips that are not well covered by public transit or at certain times of day are difficult, maybe you're more likely to use ride hailing for those.
Now, this is another one, Kyla, that really shocked me because I drive through downtown, I drive through Hollywood. And so ranked among the least frequently used forms of transportation were e-scooters. I mean, I see them everywhere I seem to go, Kyla. I mean, I can't believe it. They seem to be on every corner just sitting there. How does that How did that work?
Yeah, that was fascinating. We were very curious about frequency of e-scooter use because they get a lot of attention in the media. And in fact, we find that 94% of residents have not used an e-scooter at all in the last year. So only 6% of residents are using them, and most of those residents are using an e-scooter less than one day a week. So they're using it very infrequently.
Now, I'll admit, I haven't used one yet, but I definitely see them all over the place. It seems to me, at least, that they're being used a lot, but the numbers say otherwise. Now, finally, Kyla, the $64,000 question here. Do you use public transit to get to work?
So I did use public transit to get to work, actually, for the last 3 years. I used it every day. There's a nice metro stop right outside USC. The last couple of months, I moved, and I'm still trying to figure out how to incorporate public transit into my daily commute because it's a little harder now, given where I live.
Kyla Thomas, Associate Sociologist at the Center for Economic and Social Research at USC. Kyla, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, moving on. When wartime veterans or their spouses can no longer live independently, a government program can help them pay for nursing homes, assisted living, and home health care. The VA's aid and attendance benefit can make a big difference for people struggling to afford long-term care, but the application process is often long and very complicated. Stephanie Colombini reports for the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans.
95-year-old Army veteran Bernie Popolik is attending a birthday party at an assisted living facility near Baltimore for a fellow resident. Music plays as staff pass around cupcakes.
Bernie, like chocolate or strawberry? Both?
Anything.
You want one of each?
Popolik's been at this facility for 3 years. Staff help him with daily needs and engage him in group activities like these parties and his favorite, happy hour.
That treated me wonderful. I couldn't be treated better.
Living here costs Popolik about $6,000 a month. He pays for it with Social Security, retirement funds, and as of January 2019, about $1,900 in monthly payments from the VA.
They helped me out, I know that.
Popolik's proud the VA is recognizing his service in World War II, but securing that recognition took his son Gene nearly 2 years. At his nearby home, the younger Popolik drops a box of paperwork on his dining room table. There's bank statements, documents about his dad's service, health records, and letters to and from the VA.
It's about 25 or 30 pounds altogether, soon to be added to with another appeal.
Gene Popolik applied for aid and attendance for his dad in February 2017. His father was legally blind, had partial dementia, and struggled to get around. And his net worth was less than the maximum amount to get the benefit, then about $80,000. But as of late last year, it's close to $130,000. After months of not hearing from the VA, except for a request for his father's medical records from Germany in 1946, Popolik found out he was rejected.
I just couldn't understand why he wasn't approved.
An appeal also failed. It was only when Popolik vented on an online forum where dozens of others sought help with the benefit that a user pointed out the problem. The family friend lawyer who helped Popolik with the application filled out the wrong form. So Popolik applied again, and 6 months later, his dad started receiving the pension. Popolik's trying to recoup some of the thousands of dollars in benefits his dad would have gotten had they applied correctly.
Well, thank God I retired, because this has been my job since then, basically. It's been a strain.
Applications go through several people at the VA, each investigating different parts of the claim, like financial assets and health status, so it can be hard to clear up confusion about missing documents or wrong forms. Philip Molnies with the Maryland Department of Veterans Affairs.
The last thing you want to do is get into a letter writing contest from the VA because it just adds time.
Molnies says vets and their families often wait until they need help to start looking into benefits, so they're not prepared for the paperwork and patience it takes to get them.
It's definitely a stressful time for them. That you can hear it in their voices, you know.
Molney urges people to go through an accredited veteran service officer to make sure everything's right the first time. Those people don't work for the VA, but can be found at state, city, or county veterans offices. Then they'll have someone in their corner to advocate for them. so vets like Bernie Popolic can get the benefits they deserve as soon as possible.
Happy birthday to you.
Back at the party, the veteran sat near the fireplace and smiled. He'll celebrate his 96th birthday in May.
I hope I can make it to 100. Then maybe I'll get on today's show.
Reaching that milestone will come with a lot more assisted living payments. But Gene Popolic says the aid in attendance benefit relieves some of that stress so the family can enjoy their time with their dad. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Baltimore.
All right, when a movie comes out that has a speedster as a star, it gets my attention. I'm a little obsessed with them. Flash, Quicksilver. If they're fast and on a movie screen, I am in the front row. So a while back when there was a trailer for Sonic the Hedgehog, I couldn't wait to see it until I saw it, and it was weird. Find out why and what was done to fix it when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, we got the news covered all afternoon here on KPCC. Nick Roman hosts All Things Considered. Nick, what do you got cooking this afternoon?
Well, we know that you talked about the governor's State of the State speech today and that very heavy focus on homelessness, and we've got more coverage about the governor's plans from KPCC's Robert Grova and many more. Health officials are worried about a new outbreak of the coronavirus in Singapore, which raises concerns about the super spread of the virus. And the anger is growing over the Astros sign-stealing scandal. More and more baseball players sounding off, Mike Trout among them.
And he doesn't ever say a word
nothing.
About anything.
Right. So yeah. If you get Mike Trout mad, you've gotten him mad. Can MLB move on before the start of the season? We're going to talk about it this afternoon on All Things Considered at 4, right after Marketplace at 3 and the Frame at 3:30.
And I got to say, the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, his reviews for the way he's handled it have not gone very well.
No, it's gone poorly. It's gone poorly.
When you call the World Series trophy a hunk of metal, that's bad. Nick, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Wednesday, so you know what that means. Time to go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
And the big story this week, the case against Harvey Weinstein. Jury deliberations have wrapped up for the day, and the defense is getting in trouble for doing press. Plus, how a character redesign saved the Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Hey, Rebecca.
Hey.
So after 30 days of trial, jurors' deliberations in Harvey Weinstein's criminal trial in New York began yesterday. Where do things stand now?
Well, today was the jury's second day of deliberations. As you mentioned, they finished for the day. Today, they asked the judge to reread the testimony by accuser Mimi Halei. She's the former Project Runway production assistant who alleged that Weinstein forced oral sex on her in 2006. They also asked to review emails between Weinstein and Halei, and they were interested in actress Annabella Sciorra's testimony regarding Weinstein's alleged rape of her in the 90s. So they're looking back at the testimony that they heard and examining it in closer detail.
And there's so much news surrounding Weinstein and his alleged sexual assaults. Can you give us a recap of this particular case against Weinstein and the charges that he's facing?
So Weinstein's been charged with 2 counts of rape, 2 counts of predatory sexual assault, and 1 count of criminal sexual assault. These charges stem from Halle's allegations, as well as those of one-time aspiring actress Jessica Mann.
What's the most severe sentence Harvey Weinstein could get?
The most severe charge he's facing is predatory sexual assault. If he is convicted of that charge, Weinstein could face life in prison.
Wow. Any precedent for a case like this in terms of charges and the high profile nature of the defendant?
Well, the Bill Cosby trial has been the precedent for this in terms of there was a powerful public figure facing allegations going back many years. Weinstein's attorneys, like Cosby's, aggressively cross-examined the women, bringing the allegations in an attempt to discredit them. Cosby's first trial ended in a hung jury, and he was convicted in his second trial. There is one key and I think interesting difference between the two cases, which is that the women in the Cosby case said they were drugged. The women in the Weinstein case have not said that. And when you get into the area of consent, which is complicated to prove in a courtroom, that could matter. Interestingly, one of the first questions the jury asked the judge after they started deliberating was the legal definition of consent.
Wow. The judge presiding over the trial, that's Judge James Burke, has made it a point to clearly instruct the jury how they should deliberate. What's he been emphasizing to the jury?
Well, in some sense, Judge Burke issued, you know, the standard jury instructions about burden of proof and presumption of innocence. He told jurors to use, quote, common sense in considering what they've heard in the courtroom. He also told them to focus first on the predatory sexual assault charges, the most serious charges. So that's where they're beginning, and that's where we're seeing their questions these first couple of days of deliberation.
So there's no ETA on when they might come back. It might be a while.
Well, in terms of when we would have a verdict,
yeah.
They do seem to be going fairly slowly and deliberately at this point. They're not, you know, racing through things. Initially, this trial was expected to go through early March. However, it has moved a little more quickly than some people thought it would.
You know, and Harvey Weinstein, synonymous with the Me Too movement. How has the movement played a role during this whole thing?
Well, other sexual assault accusers have appeared at the trial outside the courtroom to show sort of support and solidarity for the victims in the case. And meanwhile, Weinstein's attorneys have made the case that his verdict has become so linked to the Me Too movement that it's actually making a fair trial difficult. That when people say this trial's a referendum on Me Too, it sort of harms his ability to be considered innocent until proven guilty.
And I guess part of the case that Weinstein's lawyers are making is in public, to the media, to the press, during the trial itself. It sounds like a no-no, Rebecca, you tell me.
Yeah, it is a no-no. And Weinstein's attorneys did a couple of eyebrow-raising things. Donna Rotano gave an interview to The Daily, the New York Times podcast. She also wrote an op-ed in Newsweek calling on jurors to, quote, look past the headlines. That's pretty bold, and the prosecution went so far as to say that it borders on jury tampering. The judge warned the defense, saying, quote, I will caution you about the tentacles of your public relations juggernaut.
Talking to Rebecca Keegan with The Hollywood Reporter. All right, let's switch gears now to the box office, which is actually marking a victory for Paramount with this movie.
I'm Sonic, a little ball of super energy in an extremely handsome package.
Now, that's from the trailer Sonic the Hedgehog, which really surpassed all expectations last week and debuted with $70 million bucks opening. Why is this a big deal for Paramount, Rebecca?
This is Paramount's biggest domestic opening in more than 18 months since Mission Impossible Fallout came out. The studio had suffered some big budget misses recently in Gemini Man and Terminator Dark Fate. And Paramount doesn't have as many franchises as some of the other studios, so they really needed this movie to work, and it did. It's also a validation of the studio's decision to push the movie back a few months when the reactions to its first trailer revealed some problems.
Well, yeah, so I remember when I saw that the trailer was out. I couldn't wait. I clicked play as quickly as possible. And then, you know that face that a puppy gives you when they're confused? That's exactly the face I had. I was like, huh? When I saw what Sonic looked like, why were people cringing or like me confused?
Yeah. Where were you the day you saw the Sonic
the Hedgehog
trailer? Yes, yes. Well, so people were, I think, confused because this version of Sonic the Hedgehog that appeared in the first trailer had this sort of fancy, lifelike CG. Now, Sonic is a 2D blue hedgehog from a video game first released in 1991. People came to know him as a kind of character in a 16-bit world with limited detail, and they wanted him to look like that. He looked cartoony in his original version, and people, I think, were expecting that. This first design of Sonic, he had these, like, kind of human-looking qualities. He had teeth. It fell a bit into the Uncanny Valley territory, it sounds like, for you as well as for some other fans.
No, but as you mentioned, so the backlash was really taken constructively, and Sonic got a total redo. Safe to say that the redesign has worked, at least for this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, the director and the studio took the fans' notes and, as you say, redesigned the character, and the results are in the box office. It's now the highest opening ever for a movie based on a video game.
But I'm wondering, Rebecca, so will studios now be prisoners to public opinion and backlash moving forward and then go back and retroactively fix things as they go along?
Well, studios have always been prisoners to public opinion. I mean, movies are a popular art form. I'm not too worried about the artistic sanctity of a movie about a blue hedgehog based on a video game.
How dare you, Rebecca Keegan?
Yes. I mean, if Martin Scorsese and Bong Joon-ho start taking notes from the internet, then maybe I'll get concerned. But this seems like a win as far as the studio and the filmmaker are concerned.
The film Cats might have taken some cues.
Right, right. Maybe it's good to heed fan reaction.
Yeah. All right, let's end on one of my favorite subjects, and that's superheroes. Ben Affleck spoke with the New York Times yesterday and shed some light into his decision to leave the role of Batman. What did he say?
Right. Well, at one point, Affleck was going to star in and direct The Batman, which is now starring Robert Pattinson and directed by Matt Reeves. Affleck said that personal problems, including his struggles with alcoholism, his divorce from Jennifer Garner, and his troubles making and promoting Batman versus Superman led him to step away. You may recall the meme of him doing some junket interview for that movie with Henry Cavill, which got terrible reviews. Affleck looked so sad that someone mixed Simon and Garfunkel's Sound of Silence over a shot of him. That really kind of characterized, I think, his experience with this particular franchise.
Yeah, it's a role that fans take super seriously. He's the sixth actor to portray the role. I mean, that had to play into the pressure that Affleck felt a little.
I mean, fan pressure is never easy for people making these movies, but some actors are able to tune it out as noise and just deliver their performance. In Affleck's case, he was grappling with these factors in his personal life, and I think that those pressures only mounted.
Now, I know that we got a little teaser of Robert Pattinson as Batman. It's very short, and it's just visual. It's him kind of coming into focus, and you see his brooding Edward face from Twilight in a Batman outfit. How has that casting played out among fans?
Yeah, this was just a camera test of Robert Pattinson in the suit that Matt Reeves shared, I think, on Twitter. The suit's redesigned. People seem to like that. Certainly female fans seemed to approve of the jawline. I don't know. Hey, you're the real comic book movie fan here. What did you think?
I dug it. I mean, look, this is one of those things, Rebecca, where you could serve it any number of ways, and I will consume it no matter what. You know me. I will definitely pay for whatever it takes to get into the movie theater, see it. But I don't mind the changes. As long as the performance is good, the movie is at least somewhat good, I'll be all in. So maybe I'm not the right person to judge this, Rebecca.
Yeah, you're too forgiving. You're too forgiving.
A little too much. But it's one of those roles, right, that no matter who puts on the suit, the pressure will be very, very extreme. Going 20 years down the road, that pressure will always be there, right?
Yeah, I guess. Although I think after surviving the rabid fans of the Twilight franchise, Robert Pattinson is probably well-equipped to deal with what's about to come at him.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins the show every Wednesday to guide us through all things Hollywood. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Zay.
All right, remember when everyone couldn't wait for cannabis, recreational cannabis, to be legal in California? Well, since it has, it's had a little bit of an unintended consequence all over the state. We'll find out what that is when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. When cannabis was 100% illegal, the price per pound was high. But ever since Californians passed Prop 64 legalizing the recreational use of marijuana 3 years ago, the economy in the northern part of the state has been in limbo, impacting far more than just the cannabis industry. For her series California Foodways, Lisa Morehouse has been reporting across the state about food, culture, and economics. She visited Humboldt County last year to see if marijuana legalization has impacted food and farming.
When I drive the commercial strip in Garberville, I see some boarded up storefronts and closed businesses. The whole place looks like it could use a coat of paint. It's really different than the thriving downtown I remember from when I reported on marijuana here almost 10 years ago.
Yay! Thanks for being adventurous.
At the end of town, Beth Allen works the takeout counter at Amelia's, which serves local food. They've known their pig farmer for nearly two decades.
He drives to Eureka with a trailer, gets whatever's left over from the Booth Brewing Company, and his pigs are raised on marijuana and beer.
Like so many people in Southern Humboldt, Beth has her feet in two worlds, running a public business and growing cannabis. She remembers when, in the 1980s, law enforcement sent helicopters into the remote hills.
We were protesting and not moving out of the way so the helicopters could land. And you see all of the rivets under the belly of that helicopter.
Back then, when it was really risky to grow and sell cannabis, the profits were high. Growers had money in their pockets that they could spend on higher-end restaurants and specialty foods. Beth rode the waves of change here, medical marijuana, the influx of get-rich-quick growers, and legalization, which she supported. Then, in 2017, she tried getting a permit to grow legally.
And I would show up at the planning department with a box of pastries, a big smile on my face, and saying, how can we help you get us through this process?
But she found it so frustrating and expensive, she gave up. One legalization expert told me it's not unusual for people to spend more than $100,000 getting licensed. At the same time, the restaurant business started to falter. 5 years ago, Amelia's added on to their takeout counter with a dining room downstairs.
Unfortunately, I have really bad timing because our community was collapsing, a beginning of the collapse.
At first, she says, they had a thriving dinner service and private parties. But legalization triggered a drop in price, under $1,000 per pound, down from over $5,000 in marijuana's heyday.
I mean, we would have no one. We would just, all of the staff, we would just stand here.
She says the takeout business dropped 50%, the dining room more than that. They stopped dinner service and went from 9 employees to 4. While a few restaurants have opened in the region, I ask around and find out Amelia's isn't alone. Waitresses from Ukiah to Eureka say they're seeing fewer customers, getting smaller tips. On the coast, a chef closed his high-end restaurant after the economy started to dip. Now, Beth says she's really questioning her earlier support of legalization.
I lay in bed at night and think, what was I thinking? I have strived to feed my community, and I pray every day for guidance of what is the right path for us and what is the right path for my community.
So I start to wonder, if restaurants are struggling, how are produce farmers doing? First, I take a detour to the little town of Whitethorn, to a cannabis distribution center for the company Flocana. A worker wheels in a pallet stacked with local cannabis, grown organically in the sun. 6 people in lab coats sit in a spotless but pungent warehouse, trimming buds. And here's where the produce comes in. On a break, employees get their weekly vegetable boxes from Daniel Stein of Bryceland Forest Farms.
Shishito peppers in it.
Go cheese.
Beets, carrots, broccoli, lettuce.
Thank you. Yeah, pleasure.
According to Flocana, the company's purchased nearly 5,000 produce boxes for its employees across the state, paying local farmers almost $150,000. This is a new revenue stream for Daniel, a small one. He's historically sold most of his produce at farmers markets, like the one I visit him at the next day.
The long cukes in this middle one, and a basket over here of like the chard and kale and stuff.
But he says he's seen fewer people here, and his income's down.
We had an economy here that was largely based on the legacy market,
also known as the black market.
And under that economy, I think money flowed more freely, people had more time.
And now?
The economy is changing to one of legitimate, I say in quotation marks, businesses based around farms that are complying with regulations on cannabis. So I think our economy and our culture right now is in a period of unknown.
And that's keeping people from spending, too. For people like Beth Allen, the past few years have devastated her restaurant and cannabis incomes. Farmer Daniel Stein and his young family are nervous, but they're trying to adapt. The next day, I go to their farm, where their values are all over the land. Vibrant row crops fill their small one-acre farm, surrounded by forest land they maintain. Daniel and his wife, Taylor, pull their baby in a wagon.
This transition time is certainly scary, watching things board up and close down. But at the same time, the community is discovering its new identity.
One that's probably going to be less flush with cash than in the past. Daniel and Taylor are pretty okay with that.
Here's kale. There's a little frog hopping cabbage to cabbage. Lemon cucumbers. So good.
Growing next to and among the produce are towering cannabis plants.
It is a more profitable crop than veggies alone at the moment, even though that is changing. Cannabis, it's a dance partner through the season. It is so rewarding to grow a plant that starts from a seed in February and is the size of a tree in November. It responds to your attention and care immediately.
I asked them, what was it like before legalization?
We had the time and the resources to prioritize and focus on the things that were important to us.
Like building up their homestead and restoring a creek on their property for salmon habitat.
And being able to experiment and push the limits with our food farming.
Daniel says now that they're spending a lot of time and money on getting permits to grow cannabis legally, they don't really have that luxury. But he says they're holding on, that they're going to keep farming their way and keep farming both food and cannabis, and hoping that'll allow them to make a living and raise their family in this place. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Southern Humboldt.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, it's 2 o'clock every single day. It's Take Two at Two. Remember, Take Two at Two, but I get it. You know, not by the radio every single moment of the day. Just look for us wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.